I think, I don't know if I said this already, I think I did, but I think the show was pitched as like the Space Odd Couple or something, the Odd Couple in Space. Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of the Audiobook Club podcast. I'm Stephen, your host for this episode, and with me as always are Jonathan, Jason and Michael. Say hello, guys.
Hello.
What's up?
Hello.
And in this episode, we'll be discussing and reviewing Red Dwarf, Infinity Welcomes Careful Drivers. Quick summary first before we get into it. So the book is set about, I think it's about 200 years in the future. And humanity has like colonized the rest of the solar system. Most of Earth's natural resources have been used up, and there's like colossal spacecraft going about, which mine for, you know, mine the different planets for different resources and that. The story follows Dave Lister, who's a sort of space bum, for lack of a better term. space waster. Feel free to use that one. And he's wound up stranded on one of Saturn's moons, after a monumental drinking session, and ends up signing up to one of these mining ships in an effort to get back home. He ends up going into stasis for breaking some rules, which is like suspended animation. So you get put in a room where time can't penetrate, so you're essentially frozen in time. And while he's in there, an accident occurs on board the ship and wipes out the rest of the crew. And he gets woken up 3 million years later, and he's basically on by himself. And a hologram simulation of his former bunkmate is there, and there's a sort of Odd Couple relationship thing going on. So that's a kind of quick overview. Why did I pick this book? Well, I'm not sure if I talked about it in the last episode, but I'm a massive fan of the show, read the book before and loved it, and just wanted to share it with my friends and get their opinions. I know Michael's read it before, and he loves it, so I was keen to see what the other guys thought of it. Now, in my typical paranoia brain, I'm concerned that the other two aren't going to like it, but sure, let's jump on that and see what they thought. I'll just jump on there, like a quick spoiler-free review from everybody. So, Johnny, do you want to kick us off here? Tell us what you thought.
So, I think in the last episode, we might have, I don't know if we discussed on the episode or we discussed it after, but I think we were drawing like comparisons that this might have been a bit like Hitchhikers.
Mm-hmm.
Which I definitely think it's, I think it's a bit more wacky, like, and a bit, definitely a bit more raw, like, I'd say British comedy. It's kind of, I'd say, what, like, the UK office is to the US office in terms of what this is, the Hitchhikers. I did think it sometimes it was a bit over the top.
Yeah.
But for the most part, and there's some pretty funny parts in this book, and I definitely think I watched the first season and a half of the TV show as well, from which I think the TV show came first in it, so the book was written more or less at the same time, but just after it.
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, it basically follows the same kind of major plot points, and I think watching the show then, just after having read the book, gave me this extra appreciation for it, and there's some, you know, absolute hilarious moments in it, which I'd like to get into more. But yeah, overall, I enjoyed the book.
Nice one. Wasn't expecting that somehow, but there we go. Jason, what did you think?
Well,
help me with it.
It's funny, like, obviously I'd left sort of at the tail end of the last podcast after the review, and I think I listened to it back there recently, which is published, and I think yourself or Michael or someone just sort of said, I wonder how Jason's going to get on with it, you know, after Hitchhiker's Gate and everything. I'm coining that phrase. I mean, immediately thought the same thing once I found out what the book was. I thought, oh, here we go. Another British dry humour sci-fi book. But I definitely enjoyed it more than Hitchhikers. Succeeded where Hitchhikers failed for me.
Class.
No, I enjoyed myself with this book. You know, I think I might have even been the first to finish it. Of the four of us.
I think you were.
Yeah. I did absolutely blast through it in like one weekend, but I did have like a big work trip. So helped that I was on a bus for about 8 hours one day. But no, overall, I had a good time with this book. I enjoyed it. And I'll give more detail when we talk about it down the line.
Nice one. That's interesting. Just thinking there. So you listened to the whole thing in one sitting?
No, I was. I was traveling down to Manchester with the football team that I work with. Don't know if I should be naming names on the podcast.
I shall be remain nameless. He said traveling down.
From Scotland. Yeah. So that was like it ended up being like nearly 4.5 hours down and 4.5 hours up. And like there was children and stuff on the bus. So like I couldn't listen to it properly the whole way through. And I definitely fell asleep at one stage listening to it on the way back up. Not because it was boring work, just because I had worked and been on the bus for most of the day. Yeah. But I definitely blasted through it quite a bit that one day. Probably half of it at least.
Fair enough. Yeah, the reason I asked about that, I was wondering if it would be like, you know, how, because I've never done that. I've never sat and read listened to a book from start to finish in one sitting, I don't think. So I'm just wondering, would I enjoy it more or less, you know, if I did that?
I don't know. Hard to say.
It's interesting. Anyway, Michael, what do you think? I know you've read it before.
Yeah, I hated this book. No, I'm only joking. Yeah, Stephen, me and you have talked about this book before. Just to let the listeners know that we have discussed it before. I think on nights out and stuff, I've always said I really like this audiobook because I think it's a great performance as well. And I would still stand by that as well. I think I've never read the physical book, but I would say this probably shines best as an audiobook. I don't think that is a too unpopular thing to say, judging by the reviews that I've also read. I think this book is a lot of fun. It obviously will draw the Hitchhiker's comparison. It always seems to do for... It does have a lot of parallels, but it's also quite a dark book when you think about like the implications of a lot of what's going on here.
Yeah.
But that's kind of my humor and my sensibilities. I find the book absolutely hilarious, especially like the two titular characters. You know, I think Rimmer is such a good character. You know, I think he's so funny. Yeah, I really have a lot of fun with this book. I find it around the same as Hitchhikers. Just it's something that really connects with me.
Nice one. Just touching on something you said there about it being a bit darker at times. I noticed this like a few years ago with the show. I realized there's a lot of like psychological things in it that you don't really notice unless you've kind of, or you're a bit older. Obviously, I watched it when I was a bit younger, so never noticed. But there's a lot of like psychological things going on. Like obviously in this book, Lister goes a bit insane at one point. And you know, has to deal with that. And there's stuff like that, like dotted in with the humor, which I think, I don't know, just makes it a much nicer, like much more bulky experience, if that makes sense. Like, much more rich or full or something. Yeah.
Like even the major plot points, I'm sure we'll get on that. But these could easily have been played like as a tragedy, like a lot of stuff that happens in this.
Aye.
But it's just seen it through a humorous lens.
I suppose it's like a black comedy, a dark comedy, really, like, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's quite like there, like the levels of a black comedy, but yeah, definitely there's definitely comparisons there for sure. But yeah, cool. No, that's, I wasn't expecting that. Anyway, that's great from good three reviews. I'm happy now. All right, I suppose I'll just jump straight into the full review then. You all know I love the book. I'll talk your ears off about it, like if I do a quick review, so it won't be quick.
You already have talked your ears off about the full over the years, so
for years. not in a wee while. Like, jeez,
I haven't seen you though.
Sorry, I'm trying to share nice things with you, just and you just never take it on board.
Like. I still remember the time you tried to share Hitchhiker's with me, Stephen. I hold it against you.
Well, a fail and a miss. Like it can't be 100%. You know, perfect record. Like impossible. That's fair. Alright, so for the full review, I've sort of broken the book up into about 6 or 7 bits. And I'm just gonna blast through them. I've cut out some parts that are sort of like, you know, they happen, but they're not major. Just so you can get through everything. But yeah, I'll go into the first sort of bit. So the first kind of section of the book is where Lister's stranded on the planet, or the moon Mimas, which is one of Saturn's moons, I think. And he's been there for a couple of years. As I said before, he ends up there after he's a monumental drinking session where he was out for his 25th birthday and him and his friends like travel around London to do Monopoly pub crawl. So they do like a drink at each of the Monopoly locations. At some point, he wanders off and blacks out. And when he wakes up, he's on Mimas with no money, some random woman's passport, and like an odd assortment of clothes. And he can't get back to Earth because he has no... He's not supposed to, it's like illegal for him to be there or something, and he can't get a job because he has no passport. So he sleeps in a luggage locker, and he's been stealing these taxis called hoppers every night to try and pay for a trip home. Problem is that everything on the planet is so expensive that it takes forever, and he ends up just spending all his money on drink. And then one of these nights he picks up this man who's like wearing a fake mustache and wants to go to the red light district. The man claims that he's going to a fancy restaurant, but he's actually going to an android brothel. This man's supposedly an officer in the Space Corps, and he's like a big deal. You find out later that he's not, but I'll get on to that when we get there. But the encounter with this man sort of inspires Lister to sign up with the Space Corps, because he thinks that he can get on an Earthbound ship. Once he gets back to Earth, he just goes AWOL, and you know, he doesn't have to do his job anymore, and he's back home. All good. Despite having no qualifications, he actually gets posted to a ship called the Red Dwarf. That's one of those mining ships that I was talking about earlier. He gets posted as a third technician, which is the lowest rank on the ship, and they basically restock the vending machines and like do general cleaning. At first, he's kind of buzzing that he's going back to Earth, but he finds out very quickly that the trip's actually going to take him 4.5 years because they're going the other way. First to do some mining before they go back to Earth, so he's a bit raging about that. He meets Holly, the ship's computer, who has like an IQ of 6,000, and he can answer any questions that are asked of him. And then we also find that his bunkmate is that mustache man from earlier, who's called Arnold Rimmer and is not actually an officer but a second technician, which is just one rank higher, so he's quite low on the pecking order as well. And the two of them are like polar opposites. Lister's a more free spirit, and Rimmer's like a highly neurotic, pretentious person who does everything by the book. And then they have that odd couple relationship that I was sort of talking about before. But yeah, that's the sort of first chunk of the book where Lister makes his way onto Red Dwarf and all that. So what did you think about this part of the book? Jason, go you first.
Yeah, as is tradition, I... tended to struggle at the very start of the book. Actually, I was really struggling to actually just follow what was happening. Like maybe the first sort of section up until he sort of got onto the Red Dwarf, I was sort of like, "What is happening in this book?" It does
jump around a bit at the start, because there's a few things that I'd mention. Like it switches POV a few times too.
I think that always just confuses me in like an audiobook at the start, or just any sort of book unless it's like blatantly obvious, but. Because also you're just getting to know the characters, getting to the voices, and you're like, I didn't really have a clue what was happening in the first 20 odd minutes of this book. But we got there, I'm pretty sure I had to look on the Wikipedia or something just to actually get my head right with the plot so I could sort of keep up with the rest of it. But once it was on the sort of Red Dwarf, I definitely coped a bit better with it all. I always tend to find as well, if I can sort of put a face to a person's name, so like I knew that Lister was like, I assumed he was Craig Charles' character, so I was able to sort of attribute that name to Craig Charles' face, which instantly like helped me follow the story a bit better as well. Well, that's just how my brain works, really. Put a face to the name.
No, that's fair. Yeah. See, I think because I've done this the other way around, where I've watched the show first and then read the book, I can sort of just natively do that. Like, put the faces in the... And Chris Barry plays it so well that I immediately know who's talking about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The Scouse accent sort of threw me a bit at the start. It grew on me. But the Scouse accent, definitely at the start, I was like, oh my God. How am I going to deal with this? But not that there's anything wrong with the Scouse accent, just this particular Scouse accent in the book. I really... It's like, oh my God, this is going to rot through my ears. But again... I warmed up to it. enjoyed the accent. I've really enjoyed the voice acting in general. But at the start of the book, once they're on the Red Dwarf, I'd started to get to know the characters a bit better. I started to have a bit of the banter. I enjoyed the opening section.
Good stuff. Johnny, what did you think of the opening chunk?
I absolutely agree exactly with what Jason said. I think this is just a symptom of, you know, when you start a new book for you've never heard the story before, or even a story within that universe, you can be a bit lost as you're getting used to the characters and stuff. So I thought, you know, the same thing. I was like, where the hell is what's happening here and where are we? And it was obviously jumping a different planet and stuff. And I was like, hold on a minute, how'd that happen? I think after the first few chapters, you get the accents. You'd be like, right, the Scouse accent is this guy. And then, I think it's, again, too, I had the same issue when I heard that Scouse accent. I was just like, oh, Jesus, is this a main character? And this is going to be this accent now for the rest of the thing. But it kind of grew on me then, they actually be listening to it as the main character. So, more or less echo what Jason said. It took a while to warm up to it. But I think, after you got through the initial few chapters, I started to really enjoy it.
There's another thing too, about, you know, obviously there's a lot of information being thrown at you here. There's a lot of world building stuff that gets just fired at you. The stuff with hoppers, the vehicles that they use and the holograms and all this here, it all comes at you quite quickly. And stuff the drug addicts and stuff where they're on, what's the guy on Bliss where he thinks he's God and stuff. And that was quite funny, but you know, just wee details like that. There's a lot of stuff to wrap your head around, I think.
The space drugs things really threw me at the start. I was like, because I remember thinking, I was like, where is this going to come in? What was the relevance of these drug addicts? You know,
Yeah.
It was a bit just like random, obviously, spoilers, but it makes sense.
I think that, not to spoil later on, but it had to come in. It had to be fed to us before it happened, sort of thing.
It's something that's mentioned is and it just at the time, I just was like, what is the relevance of that? Is it just a gag that there's drug addicts in space?
Space drugs. I think the God one was definitely a gag, but obviously the other one's not.
You don't want any of this, do we?
My son, stop! I was on a plane when I was listening to that, and I accidentally burst out laughing. But yeah. Sorry, Michael.
I actually thought it was a strong opening. I kind of knew where I was at. This is my second time listening to this, but even thinking back to my first time listening to it, I kind of knew where I was at. There is a lot of switching about of POVs, and there's a lot of heavy lifting done in this first part in terms of foreshadowing. But I think it's done so cleverly, and the fact that it is they feel like throwaway gags. But then they come back and pay later. It's kind of like, you know, when somebody tells a joke and then it's funny, and then they tell the joke again and then it's not funny, but it's told again and then it comes around to be funny. It feels a bit like that. It feels like this thing that I thought was inconsequential, that was just a throwaway little tidbit of this world, ends up being a major plot point. So I thought that was very clever. Cleverly done to kind of disguise it in plain sight like that, you know, with things like Better Than Life, you know, that seemed like a little digression at the start of the book, and then it ends up being a major plot point later in the book. Are you guys familiar with the expression of Chekhov's gun?
Yes.
Or sometimes it's described as a knife, but if a gun is, if it's mentioned in the first act, it has to go off in the third act. Yeah, I think that this sets up a lot of it hides the Chekhov's gun nearly. It sort of hides them under the guise of humor, but then they go off anyway. And somehow it's more satisfying to me that it does that. I thought it was very clever the way it did that.
Right, yeah, it is definitely hiding. Yeah, because the Better Than Life person doesn't even, they're just kind of there, while the guy that's on Bliss is kind of front and center, and he's the gag.
Yeah,
but it sets up the Better Than Life. Yeah.
I did like that.
I think I would agree with you, Michael. But I'm obviously more not jaded, but my opinion is corrupted because I've watched the show for years. So, yeah. Sorry, Jason.
No, I was just going to say just to clarify that I did actually really enjoy the sort of how they did it. You know, I really appreciated it, how this little throwaway gag became a major plot point as well. But I do remember, like, I don't know why it came into my head, but I do remember thinking, like, what was the point of that at one point? But I seen the point, you know. I did enjoy it. It did feel like a good payoff.
Okay, so the next little bit is kind of Lister's life in space for the next couple of months. So fast forward about 5 months and he's kind of sailed into life aboard ship. His routine is pretty monotonous and dull. He spends all his time either working or drinking. I suppose it's not dull when he's drinking all the time, like, but pretty sad, I guess. But he eventually falls madly in love with Christine Kuchinski, who is a navigation officer on the ship, and they start going with each other. For about 5 weeks, they're together, and Lister notices that his mood and mannerisms and appearance and everything starts to get better, like almost like he's becoming a better person. And that all changes when she vanishes with him and reveals that she was on the rebound the whole time. So then he kind of goes into like a depression spiral and misses her and eventually smuggles a cat on board to keep him company. And I'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. But then we also learn a lot about Rimmer in this section. So you learn that he was like, I think he was born on Io and he's got three brothers and he's the youngest one and they're all like, they've got really good careers and they're all high ups in the Space Corps and his parents have kind of a low opinion of him because of that. So he wants to become an officer and to do that he wants to pass the astronavigation exam, which he's so far failed 12 times. And then you kind of see a bit more has like neuroses through that and you know, just the way it goes on. So like he fails the exam so many times because he spends like months preparing a revision timetable that's like all laid up, all beautiful and stuff. And by the time he's actually done creating it, he's only got like a couple of days to revise. And he spends that time like making a new timetable, which is like much more condensed, or freaking out, or smoking, or like buying alarm clocks.
I've never felt more called out of my school and experience than that, that segment.
I've been there.
Is that you, Michael?
Is that exactly what I did. That is, yes, that is very... I did timetables with like lofty intentions. Then I remade the condensed timetables. I did stuff exactly like that.
I remember there was one time when we were in uni and it was like exam time. And I just messaged you one night and you were like revising for an exam. And the next morning you messaged me and you were like, ah, crap, I've revised for the wrong exam.
Yeah, that I remember that. Yeah, I strongly related to Rimmer in that moment.
So I can see that, all right, yeah. But yeah, so he's kind of socially inept as well, and tends to like alienate everyone around him. And he's also got this peculiar habit where he spends some time in a stasis booth, like every couple of days, to like slow his aging, which is kind of ironic when what's about to happen to him happens. But yeah, I'll talk about that again in a minute. Back to Lister. So Lister's been caught smuggling this cat because he sent pictures of himself with the cat on board the ship to be developed in the ship's lab. So another crew member arrives to escort him to the captain, but not before asking Rimmer why he's not taking his exam, because there's an exam going on at the moment. Rimmer believes his exam's actually in a month's time, but runs back to the sleeping quarters to check and discovers that no, he's included 2 Septembers on his timetable. So he panics and realizes that he has to cram a month of revision into zero time. So he decides to cheat and copies as much of his textbooks onto his body as possible. Do you ever do that, Michael? That ever happened? No.
I did write acronyms on my hands and arms. I did... Didn't go as far as full passages, but...
So while he's off running to try and get to his exam, Lister's brought before the captain, who demands the cat so that he can, like, run tests on it to make sure it's not diseased. Cats or animals or unquarantined animals are obviously super dangerous for a long-haul spacecraft because it's a closed system. So if a disease gets in, everybody on the ship's probably going to get it. So it's like a serious offence to bring such an animal aboard. So Lister won't give her the cat and she decides to put him in stasis, and he's going to forfeit the rest of his wages and spend the rest of the trip in suspended animation. It actually turns out that Lister wants to be put in stasis because he's got like so much despair over his girlfriend leaving him, and he wants to get home, and his routine's crap and all this. So he has this plan to get put into stasis so that he can just, you know, wake up and he's back home and it's all good. So when he was on planet leave, he spent all his money to buy a high pedigree cat and got it like all its jabs so that it didn't actually pose threat to anybody. And then he goes into stasis. Rimmer faints during his exam and is given sick leave. And on his way back to his bunk, he decides to like spend an hour or two in stasis, but stops to comb his hair first. The ship's reactor explodes or reaches critical mass and like unleashes its radiation, killing everybody aboard. The irony being, if Rimmer hadn't stopped to do his hair, he would have been safe.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's the sort of second chunk of the book. So I really like this part of the book because it's basically the first episode of the show. And I think it's just really well written. And it gives a good insight to like the stuff that happens on board the ship and everything. So yeah, I really like it. But over to Michael, I guess, this time. So what did you think?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this part too. This is where we were introduced to Rimmer in the last part, but this is the part where he's kind of given a name and given a personality. I really like the first scene where he's intimidating the room, and he picks the biggest out of the lot, and then he does the sound effects bonk between the lines, and it was like nearly a comic book kind of onomatopoeia thing. But and we get a lot of like the underlying darkness of this book, like the kind of cruel irony of Rimmer wanting to preserve time and being so obsessed and staying in this stasis just so he can, like, what is it, have the body of a 31-year-old or a 30-year-old when he's 31 or something like that.
He mentions about when he's 90, he'll have the body of a very spry 70-year-old or something.
Yeah. And he's by doing this, he's also distancing himself from people and like not living life to his fullest. So there's a bit of cruel irony in there. And then I really enjoy like the scenes we get on the ship, and there's a lot of great turns of phrases and a lot of Lister's inner monologue about love. I thought some of those parts were really, really funny. Some of the observations and the dry wit. I really enjoyed this part too. And then we get the catastrophe with the ship, which is one of the dark parts again that I was referring to. This could easily be played as this big, huge tragedy. And it's funny because I've never seen the show, so I didn't realize that this part was just all a big kind of massive prologue to where the show kind of begins, really.
Yeah, so this section is basically the first episode. So you start where, you know, he's going about this. They're doing their work aboard the ship. Rimmer has his exam. Lister gets put in stasis, and then the ship explodes, and he gets woken up. And you know, the first episode's called The End, which is I thought was quite good. But yeah. All right, Johnny.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Michael said. I thought the humor really started to definitely pick up too here. This is kind of where the wackiness really kicked off, with stuff of, you know, yelling around Rimmer and the exam and stuff. There's like, I think a funny bit in the actual show you get is like when he has all the stuff written down, but then it all like fades. It's all like all over his body because he's sweating and all. Yeah, it's just like so like gacky, but it's just hilarious at the same time. Yeah, and you kind of start to get the meeting of Rimmer and Lister as well. I think that the best way to describe them is kind of a bit like, do you know the characters from Peep Show? It's kind of like Mark and
Jeremy,
whatever you call them.
Jazz,
yeah.
Do you know that? Kinda, that's perfect, actually.
Yeah, it's like Lister's like Jazz, and Mark is obviously like Rimmer, but really they're just both idiots. But it's, I always like the bits, like, for example, I don't, it's probably not come up in this part yet, but it's whenever Rimmer's trying to, like, learn, it's the language, I can't remember what language
Esperanto.
Is, but, yeah, Esperanto, so, like, a form of Spanish, and I, yeah, it's like, Lister, although him being the character that you think is more stupid, he knows it really well, and Rimmer just can't seem to get it, like, so it's just kind of like these, they're more or less two idiots together, but I like the fact that, like, you know, Rimmer thinks he's this, he's got this want to be better, but deep down he's just, that's not who he is. But yeah, I think, like Michael said, you get the kind of like the dark side of this is that, like, you know, he's obviously doing this because it's how successful his brothers are, and he's probably trying to, like, please his father and stuff, and it's quite sad when you think about that.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's how this turns that into a comedy as well, so it's quite clever.
Nice one. Anything to add?
Not much more to add. I think how I would describe these characters probably at this stage of the book is that they're just both two assholes, really.
yeah.
Like.
Perfect.
I wouldn't say they're very likable necessarily at this point of the book. Not that I wouldn't say they're unlikable, but I do think more negative qualities than good qualities at this stage, definitely.
I would say Rimmer is definitely unlikable, but there is a tragic sort of feeling towards him.
Yeah, he is tragic as well. I think that's how you describe Rimmer. Like, he is just a tragic man, tragic bachelor. but I think that was all I really had to add for the stage. It's just, it's good. You know, builds the world, really introduces to the character, especially Rimmer. Gives us a lot more to him, but just between him and Lister, you're just like, yeah, you're both just assholes.
yeah, and they hate each other too.
Yeah, of course they would.
Which kind of is important for the next sort of bit.
Absolutely, a couple
exactly. Yeah, I think, I don't know if I said this already, I think I did, but I think the show was pitched as like the Space Odd Couple or something, the Odd Couple in Space. Something like that.
It definitely is.
Right, so then, the next bit, so 3 million years later, Lister comes out of stasis, and Holly, the ship's computer, explains about the disaster and how he was able to seal off the supply and transport base and pilot the ship out of the solar system to, like, avoid spreading the radiation to any nearby planets. But he couldn't release Lister from stasis until the radiation reached a safe background level, which, because of the whatever it was that leaked out, had such a long half-life that took him 3 million years. But, and Holly is worried that all this time alone, he's got a bit peculiar. Which, there's a few funny bits to do with that. So, the knowledge that he is, like, you know, 3 million years into deep space, and that he might be the last human alive, drives Lister insane. And he spends the next week sort of drinking really heavily, not getting dressed or eating or looking after himself, and he eventually collapses. He wakes up in the hospital and finds that Holly has revived Rimmer as a hologram. I don't think I talked about this, but we learned in an earlier chapter that Red Dwarf is capable of supporting only one hologram at a time, and it's typically used by the deceased crew member of the highest rank. So, like, you know, if the captain dies, you bring him back or her back or whatever. But under the circumstances, Holly has deduced that Rimmer is the best person to keep Lister sane, which I think is really funny. But it also sort of makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Then they make plans to turn the ship around and go back to Earth. Because even if the human race hasn't survived, it's like, what else are they going to do? Just drift through space for the rest of their life? So Holly informs him that he's detected a non-human life form in the now unsealed supply bay, and upon investigating, they discover, like, a desolate city that has been built in the 3 million years in the supply area of the ship. Obviously, the ship's massive, so it's probably, like, you know, a big massive town or something. And it's got, like, houses and restaurants and whatever. And suddenly, Lister gets pinned to the ground by a man in a pink suit who kind of sniffs him a bit before using a portable iron to sort of smooth out a crease in his suit. The man then apologised to Lister for attacking him because he thought he was food. And this man is known as the Cat. He's the third character of our sort of crew. And he is descended from cats. Whereas mankind was descended from apes, his kind are descended from cats. And it transpires that while Lister was in stasis, his cat, who was heavily pregnant at the time, was safely sealed along with supplies. And her, like, letter eventually evolved into this race of cats that have been living in the supplies of the ship for 3 million years. But over the last 2,000 years, they've been fighting a holy war over the name of their savior, who they think is either called Cloyster or Clister. But obviously they're both wrong, which is, I think that's a wee nod to, like, religion in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Then the majority of cats have left Red Dwarf to search for this savior and some commandeered shuttlecraft that they were able to scrounge. And they left the sort of weak and frail behind, including this man. So yeah, that's the kind of third section of the book. I think a short enough one. Let's see. We'll move on to Johnny first this time. What did you think about this bit? We're meeting the cat and, you know, bringing back Rimmer and everything.
The first point on the talk is, the Holly deciding that Rimmer was the best person to bring back. I think there's a good, like, line later on that I think it's when they make contact with Archbishop, and then there's, like, the android. What was his name again?
Crichton,
yeah. Like, he comes on and, like, cleans up the room because Rimmer wants to clean, and then Lester's like telling him that he basically, like, the boy's like, why do you want this, like, mold in the cup? And he's like, because it drives Rimmer insane, and that's the only thing that keeps me going. So it's kind of like, like, that's, yeah, exactly why he was the best person. It's an interesting choice. I think just they talk about the Holly, the computer, is just brilliant, especially in the TV show. Like, it's this pure, like, dry, like, sarcastic kind of humor.
Everything he says is pure dry.
He's hilarious. And yeah, the whole cat thing is just, although I find the cat himself quite annoying, it's more the voice than anything, like this, like, I don't know, like soul kind of character. Like fucking basically like James Brown kind of character or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
But I think the concept of how the cats evolved and the humans were 3 million years is just hilarious. I don't understand, like, he's still got a lot of these, like, cat tropes and stuff where he, like, licks himself, or he, like, he's always, like, hunting fish, like, he's always trying to get fish and stuff.
They have those smell books.
But I don't understand the whole thing with the suits. Is it, I guess it's because cats go on, like, they're so majestic or something, and they just look, like, it's like, so, they love themselves. But yeah, I think
it's because of how egotistical cats are, and they're just leaning into that a lot.
Yeah, like, I think I think whenever they first meet, the cats, they have to go back into, like, stasis or whatever, but when they're going to head back to Earth, and he's like, you can only bring two suits, and he's like, can I cut off an arm and, like, bring another suit? It's just like, in fact, two suits. But yeah, I think the cat character is hilarious.
Two suits is dead.
He's like, how many do you say again? 10?
Yeah. I thought this section again just, like, picks up more than the previous. So yeah, I think the book's just, like, constantly gets better for me.
Nice one, Jason. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I like this section. I like the sort of the build up to, like, the colony of cats.
You would like the cats.
Yeah, I like the build up to the colony of the cats. The actual character of the cat, yeah, I agree. Probably the weakest character for me. I just really don't like the voice at all. It feels almost like a caricature of anything.
Yeah.
Funny though, the character himself can be funny at times. But yeah, annoying. But I think that's just, cats are annoying.
Yeah.
As well. Like, absolutely. I fully believe that this is a cat man. You know, I think they've absolutely nailed the the actual characteristics of what the mannerisms. Yeah.
That
doesn't mean I should like them.
It's funny though, because I think in the show, this is kind of going off topic, but in the show, the cat sort of, he's basically the same as in the book, but as the show goes on, he sort of transforms and they, like, not as much of a cat, you know? He still has the suits and all, but he's more like a proper member of the crew rather than just, you know, leave me alone,
just doing rather than just, like, napping all the time. And actually, the character itself, like, grows as the show goes on, but it's good. But no, I think the characters actually well written for what they are. I think, you know, if there was, like, a evolved cat species, like, that would be how they would behave.
No, I really like this part too. I can't blame anybody who says that the cat is, as Jason said, a character or one note or annoying. I can't blame anybody for that opinion, and I don't know why, because I feel like I should feel that way too, but I just find him completely hilarious. And I looked at pictures of, like, the cast from the show, and the cat was not what I was expecting at all. I was expecting this horrifying being of, like,
it's just a guy. This,
like, yeah, I know. I was expecting something completely horrifying with, like, this 3 million years of inbred cats. Like, I thought this was gonna be, and I, what I was picturing in my head was completely different. But yeah, I just find him really, really funny. He was one note, he was a character, but for some reason that just worked for me. I thought it just fit right into this dynamic. It was like a cheap joke every time, but I still liked it.
I wonder if it's because he's not, I mean, he is, but he's not really, there's two main characters, right? Celestia and Rimmer are the main characters, and he's kind of just there to fire off the zingers every so often, you know?
Yeah.
I wonder if it's that way.
Yeah, I think if he was a main character and got as much quote unquote screen time as Rimmer and Lister, he would have been insufferable and annoying to me. But the fact that he is just a punchline, he's just a gag, it kind of just works for me.
Yeah. And what did you think about Rimmer being brought back? Any other points to add to that?
Yeah, I thought that was, like you said, Stephen, it makes a lot of sense. It makes a good reason for why several of Lister's friends would actually drive him crazy in the long run, and they just enable Lister and kind of indulge his worst behaviors, whereas Rimmer, he's so antagonistic towards Rimmer, it kind of does keep him going, like that moment that Jonathan referred to later, where he just keeps, you know, the mold in the cup. I'm sure Jonathan can relate to that, because it's the kind of passive-aggressive stuff we would have done as brothers growing up, like, you know, just doing really small petty things just to annoy the other person.
It was a saint, what are you on with?
But Michael wasn't, though, right?
Sometimes.
All right, cool. Okay, moving on then. So there's, like, maybe three more sections left of the plot. So the next sort of chunk, they sort of continue the plan to go back to Earth, but the cat is now involved, so he's going back as well. Him and Lister are going to enter stasis and hopefully just wake up in, you know, 3 million years again when they get back. Rimmer's a bit annoyed because he'll just either have to sit by himself for 3 million, or I suppose sit with Holly for 3 million years, or just get turned off. And he thinks they won't turn him back on. And I don't think they would, to be honest. Anyway, Holly reveals that because they've been accelerating for 3 million years, that they're about to reach the speed of light. And when Lister tries to tell Rimmer about this, Rimmer's kind of there as if he's speaking to somebody else who Lister can't see, and completely ignores what Lister says. Then he leaves the room, and as soon as he leaves the room, another Rimmer enters from the opposite side, and his sort of reactions to Lister's questions match what the first Rimmer had said. So it's almost like, you know, Lister saw the future sort of thing. Then they pass the cat, who's apparently lost a tooth. And once they get back to the sleeping quarters, the cat's in there trying to eat Lister's robot goldfish. So again, it's like, so there's something weird going on. And Holly explains that they're experiencing future echoes, which is a side effect of light speed travel. So you sort of see bits of the future before they happen. Around this time as well, a Polaroid appears showing Lister holding two babies. And the crew sort of ponder how they're going to get two babies aboard without a woman. Which is a fair question. Later on, an explosion rocks the ship, and Rimmer reveals that he just saw Lister die. And Lister reckons that if he can stop the cat from breaking his tooth, that he might not have to die. He thinks that the cat's going to break his tooth trying to eat those robot goldfish from before. And when he tries to stop him, he ends up breaking one of his teeth. So it's that sort of like self-fulfilling prophecy type thing, right? Later on, Holly informs him that the Navicomp computer is malfunctioning and someone needs to, like, fix it or the ship's going to explode. So Lister realizes that he has to do it, and he puts on the clothes that Rimmer said he was wearing, goes to fix it with Holly's instructions, and it doesn't explode. And obviously he's buzzing about this. And on the way back to the sleeping quarters, him and Rimmer sort of argue about it, and they discover a very old Lister on one of the bunks, who tells them that he can't see them, but he knows that they can see him, and explains that it was Lister's grandson that Rimmer saw die, and also tells him to grab his camera and run off to the medical unit where the babies are about to be born. And as he arrives, another Lister appears holding the twin babies and sort of smiles for the camera. And this is that's kind of the next chunk. So the Future Echoes. But Jason, what did you think about Future Echoes?
Future Echoes melted my head a wee bit.
Yeah.
I'll not lie. I'm pretty sure this is the sort of part of the book where I also fell asleep on the bus. So
right,
just
yeah.
To doubly make things confusing. I feel like I listened to some of this in a vague sort of drowsiness, you know. So not only was my head...
It's like an echo itself.
Yeah. So I had to sort of, again, skim through it a wee bit just to sort of keep myself updated with where I was at. It was a bit mad. Definitely the more outlandish sort of plot point to the book. And it does feel almost like a sort of self-contained episode in a way. You know, it...
Yes, it does.
It's not... It just sort of comes out of nowhere. And it's resolved almost out of nowhere, you know, it just sort of, say, like one sort of part of the book where this happens and then it's done.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think this is a good example of how all the plot points are lifted from the TV show, where they're all kind of, they're sort of an overarching story, but they are more self-contained, yeah.
Yeah, which probably lends itself better to a TV show in that regard.
Yes.
But yeah, I think it was absolutely mad whack, this section of the book. I was like the time travel essentially, which fair enough. We're in a sci-fi book with dead people being reincarnated. You know, why can't there be time travel? But still, just fried my head a bit about everything that was going on in this section.
Fair, that's fair. Yeah, Johnny, anything to add?
No, I really, really enjoyed the time travel stuff. I actually surprisingly followed along quite well, though I would be under that kind of mad shit, like, so. Yeah, like, the whole, like, different scenes that were going on, like, where, you know, people were seeing, like, the future, and it was, like, kind of a good reveal of it, too, because, you know, whenever you, the very first thing you see is that conversation between Lister and Rimmer, and it's basically him coming out of the room and going out of the room, and then another one just comes straight on. That's that stage, then you're like, right, yeah, so there's obviously something weird going on here. And there was also a lot of talk about the, like, having the speed of light, and they're all like, you know, this is something that was thought to be impossible, so we don't really know what's going to happen when we do hit it. So I knew, yeah, something mad was going to happen. But no, I really enjoyed the not only the wackiness, but also like the how interesting this whole scenario was. Like, obviously, we, from a physics perspective, we still don't really know what would happen, because obviously that is currently the law of the universe, is that you couldn't hit that speed. But I'm sure some mad stuff would happen if you ever did. So
yeah,
I just thought it was quite interesting, this take on it.
Yeah, I think this section sort of it sort of picks up the speed, pun intended, of the sci-fi nature. You know, it's got a proper sci-fi plot point, but then it also, the comedy's still there, do you know, where Lester's talking to Rimmer and he's just saying random words. He's like, what things? And he's, you know.
That's the deja vu comment, I'm pretty sure, because like Lister only says deja vu because Rimmer said it to him before, and he's like,
yeah,
you said that before. He's like, well, it really does sound like deja vu. It's like, he only says it because he said it before, do you know what I mean? It's like these kind of like infinite loops of time is just that, it's madness.
Yeah, I think the concept works really well with a comedy, like, I think. Okay, Michael, anything to add?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this part of the book as well. It was very trippy, it was very bananas, which is right up my street kind of stuff that I love. We have, like, not only the speed of light laws of physics being broken here, but there's a lot of consequence preceding the effects happening here, which is obviously a paradoxical thing that happens when time travel is introduced in stories, but here it kind of works because the laws of physics are being broken so much, you can kind of explain it away by that and say, well, none of the laws of physics will apply anymore in this kind of scenario. So yeah, it makes sense in a sort of demented, completely crazy way if you just buy into it. I thought like it was a great scene for setting up mysteries and setting up these things that would be satisfied later down the road. Setting up ticking clocks, adding a bit of suspense to the story, and I think it even added a bit of an emotional undercurrent to the story here, because with Luster's future selves, the older self, and then the more middle aged sort of, or whatever age it would have been, I think with 30s or whatever, when he had the two children.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Swiftly moving on then to the Nova 5. So. At this point in the story, we sort of briefly jump to another crew on board another ship called the Nova 5. And the Nova 5 is on an elaborate mission to create, like, exploding stars that will, when viewed from Earth, will look like, spell out a message, for advertising Coke. So this crew has completed their mission and they're preparing to travel back to Earth. But the ship crashes and kills all but three crew members. It's then revealed that Crichton, who is the ship's mechanoid, which is basically like a robot servant, he has washed the ship's computer with soapy water, and it's caused them to like malfunction completely and crash. And then we sort of jump back again to Red Dwarf, where Holly informs the crew that they've received a distress call from Crichton on the Nova 5, saying that the three female crew members are injured and they need rescue. So the lads from the Dwarf get all dolled up, and they on route to the ship, hoping to, like, you know, have some fun time with the three female crew members. But it turns out that when they get there, that the three women have been dead for millions of years, and Crichton has sort of gone a bit mad and has been looking after their skeletons. But when he's shown the truth, he sort of has an emotional breakdown and shuts himself off. The Red Dwarf crew realize that the Nova 5's engines are far better than theirs. And they attempt to salvage the ship, the two halves of the Nova 5. So they sort of spend a bit of time bringing that back to Red Dwarf using the sort of mining equipment that's on the ship. And meanwhile, Lister tries to repair Crichton, who, once he's back online, informs him that the Nova 5's engines won't be able to get them back to Earth in like 6 months or something. But the fuel decayed many centuries ago. Meanwhile, Rimmer's exploring Nova 5 and he discovers that it has a functioning hologram suite, but that all the crew's discs are corrupted. So he decides to make a duplicate disc of himself and simulate a second Rimmer. So now we have two Rimmers, which is just amazing. So with the two Rimmers, the crew now decides to repair the Nova 5. So the two Rimmers are tasked with doing that, along with some robots, some scouters that kind of potter about Red Dwarf. And the rest of the crew attempt to mine for and refine the fuel that they need to make the trip. They spend a bunch of months, and then the ship is eventually repaired and they have enough fuel. But the two Rimmers are fighting with each other because, like, it seems that Rimmer can't even get along with himself. So Lister points out that only one of them can go back to Earth because the Nova 5 will only support one of them. And he flips a coin, and the original Rimmer loses and is supposed to be erased. The original Rimmer is obviously raging about this, but he's kind of like, just turn me off now. But before he does so, he tells Lister this embarrassing story about something that happened to him. And afterwards, Lister reveals that he's already wiped the other Rimmer, which is quite funny. So yeah, that's kind of the second last section of the book. I'll go to you first again, Jason.
Yeah, this is a strong point of the book for me. I really like the tale of two Rimmers.
Yeah.
I thought, like, the sort of section where, you know, after a few months and they were arguing with each other and only one of them could live, I think this was probably, like, one of the stronger, like, story notes in that, like, that sort of dread, that sort of fear. You know, I think, as yourself and Michael sort of said, like, they could really have just done this as like a straight horror, maybe, or like, you know, more dramatic, definitely. I think this was probably like the biggest bit for me. I mean, there was also the sort of the voice in my head saying, well, of course the original Rimmer is going to survive. But, you know, I was pushed that to one side and suspended my belief and just let myself go for the ride. And the fear that, even though I've grown to remember probably by this stage of the book, I still think he's an asshole, but he's definitely a lovable asshole at this stage. But yeah, it was quite nervy at times.
It's weird that like they should be identical, but you do root for one of them somehow.
Yeah, it's like it's still like an evil twin almost. You know, it's like the Bart that they've locked up in the attic.
That's exactly yeah.
I can't remember what the story was now. The embarrassing story.
Gazpacho soup.
The gazpacho.
Gazpacho soup. Yeah.
Oh yes, that's right. The gazpacho soup.
I'll touch on that. Yeah.
I enjoyed that story actually. I enjoyed in the sort of following chapter what that led into. One thing that do want to mention, and I can't remember when exactly it's happened, but it's definitely happened at least once or twice by this stage of the book, is the bloody theme music that plays.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Not a fan.
No, I don't know why they did that at the start of each sort of... But it seemed the first time was okay, but then it got annoying. Yeah,
yeah, well loud,
and it was well loud, very droney as well.
No, I wasn't a fan of that, but I enjoyed the actual story, the plot line of this, and I like Crichton. This is the sort of first we met Crichton, wasn't it, aboard the Nova 5? And so again, just from knowing like what the cast sort of looks like, Crichton's like the guy, like the big androidy, metalheady sort of guy.
He's got like a weird head. Yeah.
Like, so I could picture him, and I was wondering when he was going to rock up, purely just so I could again put a face to the name. But yeah, no, he's a good character. I liked him, and I liked the sort of plot line of him being like quite insane after spending all this time on his own as well.
And he doesn't want to like. He just wants to clean stuff. He doesn't want to do any of the mining.
No, he just wants to clean.
Because he has a cleaning robot.
He wants to serve.
Good man.
It's very funny. Do you know what? Going back to Rimmer, though, I do think it's quite an interesting question. Like, if you had a copy of yourself, would you get on with the copy?
No.
So no, I don't think so either. I don't think I would like that guy.
Me and Copy Michael would make so many podcasts together.
You'd make the Michael podcast.
That's weird. All right, cool, Michael. Original Michael, what did you think?
I really enjoyed this part. Just for the listeners listeners out there who do not listen to the book before they listen to the episode, the gazpacho soup story is just basically Rimmer did not know that gazpacho soup was served cold, and this was a great embarrassment to him at the captain's table, and he suspects this is why he was never invited back to the captain's table and why he never progressed his career. So he sees this as like his ultimate failure. And it also like harkens back to his original self. His final thought, I believe, before the ship blew up was gazpacho soup.
I think so.
So again, this is another example of how dark this book is. You can't even say underneath the surface because it's right there. I thought it was hilarious them all getting spiced up before they... Was it Lister putting on the shirt with like it was his good shirt because it only had like one curry stain or something like that?
Yeah.
And
the show is so funny when he's getting dolled up because like all his clothes really? Are just there's holes and all in them and stuff, and like
I would like to see that in the
show. He like puts on a pair of jeans and like there's a full hole in one of the arse cheeks, so he just like gets a can of spray paint and sprays over it.
I thought it was very funny in the book, so I imagine it would be very funny in the show. The part then with the they come across the bodies again. It's just Lister is such a lonely man because his only allies is like a cat man, a hologram, AI things, and then he finally could potentially find some companions in this lonely abyss, and then it's these dead women. So it's. When you like scratch beneath it, you know he's incredibly lonely. But I'm sure he doesn't see it that way because he comes to really like the hologram Rimmer, as we learn in this part, because he preserves one. And I think that's an excellent way to exhibit like character growth too. That the two Rimmers, it's not only the two Rimmers hating each other because that's just what Rimmers do. It's also the fact that the older Rummer, the one that we know more, kind of hates what he was as well, and he kind of finds all his old traits insufferable.
Yeah, it's almost like he's changed. Both living with Lester for the last couple of months, he's sort of changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the new Rummer sort of points that out as well.
Yeah, and I think that's... Yeah, he does, exactly. And I think you guys even kind of hinted at that with your own opinions of Rummer, the fact that you said you're rooting for the older one. I think that kind of shows that we feel his growth and we have become more attached to him because of that. He's still very much in the asshole range, but he's like 2% less asshole, so it's kind of an arc.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts about Crichton?
Crichton, yeah, I thought I was fine, you know, it wasn't... It's not like a standout character for me or anything. Yeah, I like all the characters in this book, honestly, but it wasn't anything special for me or anything.
Yeah, I think for Crichton, it's sort of a thing with a cat again. He sort of starts out one-dimensional, and then he evolves as the show goes on. And then I would even say in the later seasons, he's my favorite character, but yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He gets really funny, yeah. All right, Johnny, anything to add?
It picked up again in this chapter, or these few chapters. Yeah, the whole Crichton thing with the woman, which I thought was hilarious, like the getting ready, getting dolled up. I thought the, even like Holly, I'm pretty sure, like puts on like a toupee, or is that might only be in the show.
Yeah.
But yeah, like he does. He's supposed to be this, you know, advanced AI with 6,000 IQ, not supposed to care about women or whatever, and he puts on, like, he's dolling up as well.
I think he even says that too. He's like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
This is quite funny.
Yeah, that whole scene was quite funny. And then I think that, like, before they go on, like, they obviously, again, you have this kind of relationship between Rimmer and Lister, where obviously they're going to be potentially flirting with Garrett here, so they're each other's competition, but they're also, like, supposed to be wingmen and stick together. So I think they have a thing where... Rummer wants Lister to, you know, big him up and basically call him Ace, which he says is like nickname. And I think he's like, whenever he gets, he's like, I want you to call me by my nickname. And he's like, what, Bonehead? And he's like, how'd you know that was my nickname? He's like, I just have a guess or whatever. But he's like, no, my other nickname, basically, that no one else called him. And he was like, it's Ace. And then he also wanted to say, tell him that he was like incredibly brave. And then whenever they see that it's like three dead women, then Lister starts, you know, joking about him, like, and did you know that Ace here is extremely brave and all? If you're like taking and a hand at him.
Had sex with lots of women and everything.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just hilarious scene. Yeah, the whole thing with deletion I thought was quite, again, funny, but also, yeah, quite a humane, nice moment. Yeah, but that's, you know, Lister obviously has the choice, and really, you'd think high level, it doesn't really matter which one he deletes because they're both the same. But yeah, there's the one that has been with him this whole time and has been, you know, maybe improving. And there's like, if he obviously deleted that one, he would have to go back to square one with the Lister, because I'm pretty sure like the hologram is obviously taken from a point in time, you know, whenever before this all happened.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's mad that like they've kind of like, even though it is like an identical hologram, it's like there is a difference. And yeah, it's I think you said, Stephen, it's mad you're like rooting for one, even though they're both dickheads. It's funny, like.
Yeah.
But now, yeah, I thought this whole section was brilliant again, just another step up again and added to the story, and yeah, really developed the characters' relationships.
Yeah, just to touch on one thing you said there, you were talking about Rimmer's nickname of Ace.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of like tie-ins like this in the book and the TV show where, so he wants him to call him Ace, but in later seasons there's another Rimmer gets introduced for an episode or two, and he's called Ace Rimmer, and he's from a parallel dimension who is really cool, and everybody thinks is like, you know, hot and cool and all, and it's just a nice wee nod to that. I think it's quite funny.
So rather than from a parallel dimension, he's from a perpendicular one, because he's like,
oh, well, yeah.
Completely different.
It's quite funny, yeah. Cool. So I'll move on to the last sort of section here, and this is where it goes a bit mad again here, but... yeah, so this is the returning home, inverted commas, section. So, they've repaired the Nova 5, and they make the trip back to Earth, which takes them 6 months, and it was a success. When they get back to Earth, humanity is basically the exact same, and the crew have now become space heroes. Lister doesn't really like the fame and notoriety and everything, so he kind of moves off to a small town to live in peace, essentially. And he ends up marrying Christine Kachansky, who was his girlfriend on Red Dwarf. But it's actually like her direct descendant, and also is completely identical. Red flag there. They have twin sons, and Lister's never been happier. But his arms start hurting, and he gets this ointment for it. And when he rubs the ointment on it, it spells out a message. It spells out messages like dying and U equals BTL. And he sort of tries to figure out what that means. Rimmer, meanwhile, has become the world's third richest man. And he spent all his money investing in a company that's developed the Solid Gram, which is basically a hologram with a solid body, and he can interact with stuff. So he's made a fortune out of that. He's got various properties, and he's a beautiful Brazilian wife, and he's all happy. But Lister starts to realize that his life is sort of impossibly perfect. He's married to a woman that should be dead, or somebody who's the exact same as her. He's got two babies that can change each other's nappies, and they can even drive a car and stuff. And it's Christmas Eve every night, so he's starting.
And he lives in Bedford Falls.
Which is from It's a Wonderful Life, which happens to be his favorite movie. So he sort of realizes that what has happened to them, and he flies to Paris to meet Rimmer, who's having this huge party with loads of people. And he informs Rimmer that they're playing Better Than Life. A callback to the first section where we talked about that VR game. It's a game where all your fantasies come true, and it kind of sucks you in, and you don't want to stop playing it, so you get stuck, essentially. And they're still on Red Dwarf, so they never left in the Nova 5. Rimmer's a bit dubious because it seems real, but then he sort of gives in when he realizes that his house guests include God, Archimedes, and Lenin, who are all playing cards and getting blocked. It's now that Lister mentions it's a bit strange. So they sort of fly off to Denmark where the cat lives, and any doubts that they had that it's not a simulation are kind of dispelled when they meet the cat, because he has been living in a castle surrounded by a milk moat, and he's got a staff of an army of Valkyrie warrior women, which is completely unbelievable. And at this point Crichton appears and explains what had happened. So it turns out that while they were celebrating, fixing the Nova 5 and everything, the cat finds this cache of headbands for Better Than Life, and he puts one on. Then Lister and Rimmer went in to save him, and they also got stuck. And Crichton spent the last 2 years looking after them, feeding them and cleaning them and making sure they didn't hurt themselves while aimlessly wandering around the ship, before Holly convinces him to laser warnings into Lister's arms. And then Crichton obviously enters himself, but he's sort of unaffected because he has no desires other than a new squeezy mop, which he gets, which is nice for him. They decide to leave the game, but Lister says he wants one more night with his family because he can't bring himself to leave them on Christmas Eve. However, in Bedford Falls, it's always Christmas Eve, so he kind of just becomes trapped again, and they never get out. And that's how the book ends. So, Michael, what did you think of this last section, the Better Than Life section of the book?
Yeah, I thought this was an excellent way to end the book, an excellent section. It's funny just how much it spells it out to you, so that you kind of... I remember the first time I listened to this, I remember I forgot about the It's Better Than Life game, so I was kind of like, this is so bizarre, why is all this stuff happening? And then... you kind of, when he gets the marks on his arm, and then you're like, oh yeah, that's right. And then you kind of slowly come to the realization then. I thought it was so funny seeing Rimmer's fragile ego being displayed, and his vision, the fact that his wife is she's not even faithful to him in his wildest fantasy.
Yeah.
And he's beating these best generals of all time at these strategic games, and then I think one of them doesn't know gazpacho soup is served cold, and then Rimmer reassures them, and he's like, obviously that's what he wanted that all that long ago when he made that mistake.
I was not Prince Charles or something like that. I didn't know the gazpacho or something.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, I thought that was so funny, and I thought the ending was. Again, another pretty dark part of the book, being trapped in this forever. It was probably a bit abrupt is the only thing I would say about it, and that seems to be because if you look at the title of the book that follows this, this was very much a setup to that book, so that's why it feels
like I've read the second book, and it's a direct tie-in. It goes from where this book leaves off.
Yeah, so I thought it was still a really good ending, so it was, but yeah, it just felt a bit abrupt at that, but...
Okay, and what did you think about the cat's, like, Valkyrie castle?
Yeah, Haz was just... yeah, Haz was just completely over-the-top ridiculous. I still am struggling this entire review to believe that the cat is just actually a man, because I had this, like, feral, like, hairy cat creature in my head the whole time.
Yeah, he's just a guy with fangs. That's about it.
That wears suits. Yeah. Like, that's about it.
He's always wearing a suit. Yeah, that's about it. Right. Okay. Jason, anything you want to bring?
Yeah, I thought this was a strong final chapter. I would agree that the ending did just feel very abrupt. Like, there wasn't really much closure, maybe necessarily, with the ending.
Yeah.
I've never actually seen A Wonderful Life, so I never actually picked up that's the street they was living on. I knew they had mentioned that street beforehand, so I knew there was, like, relevance to it, but I didn't sort of put two and two together that was why it was Christmas Eve every night. So I've only just realised that now that you, Michael, have mentioned it. But I did find it very touching that, you know, Lister's fantasy was just to have, like, a wife and kids that he loved and just, like, a normal life. I thought that was really nice, and that really spoke a lot to his character and made him very likable. You know, maybe actually, if anything, maybe cured his assholeness. The jury's still out on Rimmer. He's still an arsehole. No, it was a good end. I really liked it. Strong ending.
Good stuff. Cool. And Johnny, finish us out there.
Yeah, I liked, again, yeah, how Lister he was, the kind of character, you know, just liked the simple things. And yeah, I thought it was very, very nice and satisfying that he just, you know, wanted, all he wanted was this. They settled down with sweet family with the girl next door kind of character. And yeah, I thought Lister's whole thing was quite interesting. Yeah, it's funny, like, he made himself in this fantasy. He's like this big successful, but yeah, I think Michael mentioned, like, his hot Brazilian wife of his, like, you know, wasn't even faithful to him. And he's also made himself the third richest, why not the first?
So I know, yeah.
These, like, insecurities still exist within his mad fantasy. He's still... Even though this is, he can dream up whatever he wants here, he's like still being, you know, not exactly full on. Yeah, I thought that's just quite interesting point of his character. And yeah, again, the cat, just absolutely madness, his fantasy, like, as you'd expect. I do agree that the ending was abrupt, but I guess, yeah, if that's just, it's more or less like the first book is actually just like, you know, the first two books is one book, just part one and two, essentially. So it's more just they split it on the size of it as opposed to, you know, that it's a complete story by itself. It's very much, you know, kind of, you would need to go on to the second one now to continue on, which I definitely plan to do in the future.
Yeah, I think they might have wrote this as, like, you know, one big book. And then I'm kind of thinking now, where else would you split it up? You know, I can't really think anywhere else from what I remember of the second book where you would cut it. Yeah,
I think this is like, it kind of does make sense to do it there because it's like, they were heading back to Earth, and you think they are back on Earth now. Like, I like the twist that they weren't, they were on the game. I think you quickly kind of realize that they're on, that someone's not right here because, like, of the ridiculousness of, like, Rimmer's success. But to be fair, I thought I was a bit caught by the twist initially. And I think, yeah, it was good because, like, you think that this is the climax of the book, is that they are, like, back on Earth now. This is them finished. They've made it home. Only for that they'd be pulled out from under you. So I actually think that, yeah, it was quite a clever ending. Yeah. Break it down, like.
Nice. Well, I guess we'll move on to star rating now. So I suppose I'll go first. As I said, I love the book. Can't really fault it, but I don't think I'll give it a 5. I think it would be 4.5, maybe. You know, it's definitely a book that I would listen to again. Narration was amazing. Chris Barry, fantastic job. I think 4.5. I like that it's still faithful to the show, but it also introduces a lot of new stuff. Do you know? Michael, what about you?
Yeah, Stephen, I was just thinking if I could copy and paste what you said, I probably would do that. Amazing narration, had so much fun with the story. This is the second time I listened to it, so I have listened to it again, and it was a pleasure to listen to it again. I would not give it the 5 either. I just think I give the 5 to Hitchhikers, and I think just listening to that, it was just constant joy and fun. And this was almost there. It was the next best thing, I would say. And I know it's probably a cliche to compare these two books at the same time, but it was always going to happen, you know, with us covering Hitchhikers first. Yeah, so it's just not there at completely top marks for me, but it is very close. So I would also give it a 4.5 as well.
Cool. Johnny?
Overall, I thought this book was really good. The narration, as we've touched a wee bit on, was brilliant. You know, his range of voices, even though I hated the cat and the Scouse accent at the start, got me a little bit. I just thought his range was brilliant, and all the accents were so distinct and just brilliant. The story just kind of, I've been saying, it just got better chapter on chapter. Like, it just built the whole way out for me. A lot of interesting, wacky concepts. Sometimes I felt the only gripe I would have is, like, the wackiness, especially surrounding, like, the cat, was a bit over the top. It might not always be a bad thing for most people, but just some of the times I just thought, like, what the hell is going on here? Like, what am I listening to? But yeah, overall, I really enjoyed it. So I am going to give it a 4.
Cool. Save the best for last. Big finish, Jason.
Big finish, that's what they call me. Yeah, I tried, like, I think what Michael said, it's hard not to compare this book against Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I really tried to not sit and compare it the entire time. I hope I haven't done that during this review, because I know it's...
I don't think you have
quite, at all. It's quite cliche of me to just fucking riff on Hitchhikers at this stage. But I think this succeeded where Hitchhikers failed. I think, you know, the humor was there. It's funny. I think the actual tension and, like, the dramatic elements were much better. I still think it had its faults. You know, I by no means a perfect book, but if we were to compare it to Hitchhikers, for me personally, I think this is so much better. Again, I echo Johnny. Like, it's, I think each chapter it sort of got better, and I do think the final 2 chapters are probably my favorite parts of the book.
Nice. Except for Future Echoes. Future Echoes was not good.
Well, I think that was the third. The third last chapter, wasn't it? Yeah, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't get better every time.
No, well, true, you're right. Future Echoes is probably my least favorite chapter, if not maybe just the initial first chapter. But no, it's good. I would like to give this book a 3.5 out of 5.
There we go. So that's average at 4 stars.
There you go. Didn't think you'd get that, Stephen, did you?
Nice.
Didn't think I would get that, no. I thought it was going to be me and Michael high and he's too low, but there we go.
That was a good time.
Cool. All right. So I suppose we'll move on now to comparisons. I have a few, but I suppose, do you just want
to... I would like to compare it to Hitchhikers.
Yeah, saw that coming.
Did you ever hear of this book called Hitchhikers, by chance?
I think
this book, as I've referenced this show many times on this podcast, weirdly a lot of times for having nothing to do with audiobooks, but I felt so much Futurama in this story. I think there's massive influence on Futurama from this.
Well, obviously the big one is the stasis, or, you know, cryo.
The freezing,
yeah.
I never even crossed my mind, Michael, but you're absolutely spot on, yeah. Like, it is just British Futurama.
Which is a show I absolutely love, like, so that's probably why it resonates with me so much.
Yeah, same here. I could watch that fucking show for days.
Personally, I think Futurama is far superior to this, but I mean, I've not watched the Red Drawer.
But you haven't watched the show.
I haven't, but I'm not. Well, I suppose that's the other thing. I don't actually have any intention of watching the show after reading the book.
That's fair enough.
I've said that sort of opposite regarding Slow Horses. I have no intention of reading the books, but enjoy the show.
That's fair enough. Like, as long as you got some enjoyment out of it, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Well, the show was on BBC iPlayer, and it's only like, you know, 20-minute episodes, 6 episodes a season, so it is handy to watch.
Oh, that makes me more likely to watch it if it's that short.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the big comparison is The Odd Couple, first of all, but then the show itself, obviously. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, for other media, that's the main one. So I sort of touched on it a few times, but the plot points are all lifted from the show, but there's a lot of stuff in the book that doesn't happen. For example, all the stuff on Mimas at the start, that doesn't happen. You kind of come in and Lister's already on board the ship, and you don't know why he's there, or you know that there's he's trying to get back to Earth or anything. That's never alluded to. And then some stuff happens differently, like the whole Nova 5 thing about it crashing, that's never talked about, but then, stuff that happens differently, so like Rimmer's double appears, but it's kind of, you know, they don't fix up the Nova 5 or anything like that, they just sort of love together, and they drive each other mad, and then like smuggling the cat is different as well, because he doesn't do it because he wants to go back to Earth, he just does it because he's lonely and stuff, so there's a lot of differences, which I think kept it kept the book interesting for me the first time around. But it also kind of builds on the world, so that's one reason why I really liked it. Trivia. I've got a few bits of trivia if you want to hear it. Like,
go for it.
Yeah, go for it.
The first one, Chris Barry, the narrator, I think we talked about it before, but he is one of the characters on the show. He plays Rimmer, but he's also like a comedian. And I think in the 80s and 90s, he would do like impressionist stuff in his stand-up show. And that's why I think his performances are so good. Because, you know, he has obviously worked with the cast for so long. So he's able to, and he's an impressionist. So he's able to like copy their, you know, the way they talk and perform their, you know, their lines and stuff. But I think he's just spot on. Particularly Lister and Crichton. I think he's got them like to a T. And then also, there's three, this is the kind of bigger, interesting one for me. So there's three sequel books to this. There's Better Than Life, which we sort of talked about already. It's a direct sequel. But after that one, something strange happens. So the two creators of the show, Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, they, like, in the mid-90s, they decided to sort of go their own way. So one of them stayed writing the show, and the other one went off to do his own thing. But they'd already been contracted for two books. So they decided that each of them would write a different book, like their own story, in the same, like as its own sequel. So there's two sequels to Better Than Life. Which is kind of weird. So, you know, it's almost like parallel universe type thing. So I think it's quite interesting.
That's quite interesting.
I haven't read either of them.
That's interesting.
But I do intend to.
I wonder if that's how they explain it. Like, do they be like, this is like a parallel story that like a, like an alternative, you know, universe or something, like, or how did they actually like
spark? Could be. I'm not sure, but I am interested to listen to them or read them. I think it's more of the same though. They sort of left more stuff from later seasons of the show, you know, and adapted a bit, but again, I haven't read them, so I don't know. I guess we can just move on to what else we're consuming.
I mean, I have plenty I could chat about since I missed out on this the last time. I don't even know if I've told you, I feel like it's been a while, but I did finish all three seasons of Slow Horses. If I had to rank them, I would probably say season 2 is my favourite. I don't know if you agree or not with me there.
I think I would agree, you know. I think I would.
I think I would say season 3 is probably my least favourite.
I think I would agree as well, yeah.
Right, yeah, well, there you go. But a really good show, definitely. Season 2 is very good, like definitely the highlight for me. I've just been battering through The Wire. I'm almost finished season 4. Watched the new season of True Detective of Mary Kate. Wouldn't recommend that. since we sort of chose Red Dwarf, like I said, sort of blasted through that in like one weekend. I think I've managed to complete two other audiobooks and start my third. If not, yeah, I think that was it. So I managed to listen to Psychopath Test by John Ronson, which was an interesting read. Surprisingly, like a lot of non-fiction, actually. Another audiobook.
If I read this Psychopath book, is there a test in it? Because I'd be scared in case I was...
Well, it talks about the test, but I don't think the actual test is like fully written out. That was quite interesting. Actually, yeah, there's I finished three books because I recommended one to you, Stephen, and you didn't like it, and that was the This Is Gonna Hurt by.
Yeah, I might give it another try.
The, I can't remember what his name is now, but that NHS doctor, a former NHS doctor.
Adam.
Yeah, I can't remember what his name is now, actually. But like best-selling book. Also listened to Jeanette McCurdy's book.
Nice.
Back when I was about in Derry for a few days. There's definitely another one or two, actually. I've absolutely blessed through the books recently. Oh, yeah, and then I moved on to an actual author from Derry. Seamus O'Reilly. He has very short book out called Did You Hear Mammy Died? It's only about 4.5 hours long. That's quite funny. Just about his experiences as a child of, you know, from a family of, you know, two parents and 11 children, all from the border, essentially. But the mum dies quite young. That was quite interesting, especially from him being from Derry and like sort of naming streets of Derry and everything like that. I've now finally moved on to No Country for Old Men, so just sort of back on that Cormac McCarthy grind that I stopped after Blood and Reading for a while. But I'm only about 2-3 chapters in, but I do feel like it's a lot easier to follow along compared to Blood and Reading. I just don't know what it is about Blood and Reading compared to other Cormac McCarthy books, but
it's all the death.
Between The Road and between the No Country for Old Men.
Relentless sadness.
Yeah. I could follow along with these two so much easier than I could with Blood and Reading. I don't know what it is. I just don't think Blood and Reading lends itself to audiobook form that well. But we discussed that in length before.
Yeah.
And that's I mean, yeah, I was saying to you guys, I booked my honeymoon.
Nice.
Off to Mexico. That's me. All caught up.
Very nice. So, Michael or Johnny, do you want to go next?
I've been back playing Assassin's Creed. I'm on to Revelations now, and I've also almost finished it and got Assassin's Creed 3 downloaded. I really liked Assassin's Creed 3, so I'm looking forward to playing it for the first time in 10 years. I've been reading another audiobook I've been doing, The Republic by Plato. Don't know if any of you have ever heard of Plato. Pretty smart guy, like. But yeah, it's about, I think it's basically about like government and stuff, and like what's the perfect kind of like government, like they rule over a city and stuff. Obviously written back in, you know, the BC times, so it's a pretty old book. Basically a lot of like two chapters on that, but like it's basically, it starts with like Socrates like talking with people, and he's like more or less trying to get somebody to contradict themselves. He's like, do you believe that you know, a good person is just, and okay, if a good person is just, then is this kind of person just? And then, you know, he goes in this big loop. They just end up getting round to make the person contradict themselves. I was like, geez, he was a bit of a dickhead. Making people like roast themselves, basically. But no, it's quite interesting. Yeah, apart from that, it's getting into the summer, some more closer to the summer months now. So I've been doing a bit of pre-gardening, you know, so I'll have to update about whatever's been grown this year. I've got a lot of stuff on the go at the moment. Be too much to go through, but well, sure, I'll go back and do whatever's actually coming through then whenever we start getting fruits. But also, I think I mentioned this last time, I've been doing like reading a physical book. So for February I was reading the Chinese Myths book. I actually haven't finished it yet. I'm a little bit behind, but I'm almost, I've only got like 20 pages left. So basically get finished tonight or tomorrow. But yeah, quite an interesting book about the Chinese mythology. I remember I read that book, The Art of War, is also like a Chinese book. So like you get a lot of like names, I think, are quite hard to like remember and stuff. So it's quite hard to like follow a lot of the names. Like, you know, if I were reading a Greek book, I could hear like the name Zeus and like I remember that. But the Chinese ones are obviously Chinese names. They're more of the Chinese style. So I just find them quite hard to remember. But in terms of the actual like their stories and stuff, you can see like a lot of similarities between a lot of Western myths and stuff, but then there's also some like mad stuff as well that happens. So yeah, it's quite an interesting mythology. And my next book that I'll be picking up for March is going to be the Atomic Habits book, which is, I think it's James Clear, is it? Keir bought me it for my birthday, so I think that's quite a popular one at the minute. I think it's some guy, you know, kind of like a self-help kind of book, you know, going through different habits that people are, like, bad habits that people have and how they fix them and stuff. So that'll be an interesting one. So that'll be the book I'll be starting hopefully in the next few days. Yeah, that's pretty much me.
Michael, what you got?
Yeah, haven't consumed as much stuff as I normally would like to because I applied for a few jobs and have been like preparing for them, like a couple of are like internal into the current workplace that I'm on, and then another was like a media job. So I got to, like, as I said to you guys on our chat, I got to drop the podcast in there as like a selling point, which was funny. I haven't heard anything back yet from my interviews. I've attended a couple now. It's been a stressful week. I do not like interviews, but I don't think anybody really does. I finished Succession with Greta. That fourth season ending was spectacular. It was so good. I miss the show so much. It's already, we haven't picked anything up again yet, even though we said that we would jump right into another show. We've just kind of let the week stretch out and like mourning of not being able to watch the show anymore. I listened to a few audiobooks as well. I listened to Columbus Day by Craig Allinson, which is like it's kind of a military sci-fi book. It's a really fun book. So it is, and the narration in that book is fantastic. I think it would be an interesting book for us to cover on the show one day. I'm not sure how everybody would feel about it, but I really like the book, so I might pick it one day. I finished a book called The Painted Man by Peter V. Brett. It's like a epic fantasy one. It wasn't my favorite book, but yeah, I still enjoyed it okay. And I listened to Bully Summers by Stephen King, which is, I never listened to that before. As far as like in the King rankings, I'd probably put it somewhere near the bottom middle. It wasn't a classic, or it wasn't classic King or anything, but it was pretty solid, kind of crime, one of his crime books more. But other than that, I've been, you know, writing away as well. I've been working on the book still. It's grown far beyond what it was when I talked about it a few months back. It's just kind of taken on a life of its own, as pretentious as that sounds, where like it feels like it's kind of writing itself, and like that I'm slowly losing control, and that it's just it's its own entity. It's probably the best thing that I've written, but it's still, I think it's still not really near ready. It's needs a lot of work still, but I'm chipping away at it, and I will be sending it out when it's done. But it's still, there's still a lot of moving pieces to be put together in it, and a lot of different things need worked out, and a lot of sections need rewritten, and a lot of characters need rejigged, and a lot of things that weren't foreshadowed need foreshadowed, and just a lot of shit. But I'll get there in the end. But yeah, that's it. That's everything for me, basically.
Good man. I suppose for me, still watching, like I said on the last episode, watching a lot of Naruto. Watched a couple of episodes tonight. Doing a lot of Japanese as well, on Duolingo. Got into Diamond League there. It was pretty good. People on that are nuts, though. They're never off the thing.
Wait until you get into the Diamond Tournament, lad. Even worse.
Aye.
Jeepers, there's people getting like 10,000 experience every day.
Here, every day, Jesus.
Hi.
It must never be off a thing. I got into Diamond League, and you know, I was, the first couple of days, I was like, you know, putting in maybe a couple hundred a day or something, right? But then I really lost heart when the first place person had like 20,000 points in 3 days or something. And I was like, yeah, okay. I give up. Fuck that. But yeah, just cracking on with that. It's quite enjoyable. I'm listening to Ready Player One again at the minute. I just wanted something light. I just wanted something after that Doctor book that was a bit more light, and you know, I can just put it on and not really pay attention. The Doctor book, I think I'll give it another. What was it called? This Is Gonna Hurt. The one you recommended me just now. I think I'm gonna give it another go. I don't know what it was about it that I didn't like. As I said, I couldn't pinpoint it. TV wise, I'm watching Spaced every so often. Another British TV show with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost and Bill Bailey's in it and stuff. What else? I'm trying to think. I'm not playing any new games at the minute. Still playing World of Warcraft like a wee gremlin. And yeah, that's about it. Actually, I wanted to ask something. So I was going to watch the Dune film, the first one. Yeah. I've never watched it before. Don't slate me for that, Michael or Jason or Johnny. But I was thinking about reading the book first. And then, Michael, you're the type of guy who's done both. So which would you recommend do first? Yeah.
I've done both as well.
Have you?
Yeah.
You've read Dune?
I've read about half of it physically. I've listened to the full audiobook. And I've seen the film twice. The most recent film twice. Not the news release, but the Dune Part 1. I don't know.
Like, would it ruin it for me if I watched the film first?
Well, the book itself is the two films together.
Right.
So Dune Part 1 finishes only about halfway.
I think you could do either, Stephen. I think there's no real way that one would ruin the other. Like, I don't think it would...
Lessen my enjoyment of the book? I suppose it would, because I wouldn't know the plot and stuff, but I don't know.
I think if you were looking for the optimum experience, I would say the book first. You know, I think it would deepen the movie more than the other way around. But one thing I would warn you about the Dune book is it is quite dense, and it's on a lot of people's did not finish shelf. It's kind of strange the way it plays. It's like treads this line between fantasy and sci-fi, and it can be a wee bit dense, but once you kind of get into the flow of it, it's the way it seems to work with that book, is it just clicks for people at some stage.
Right.
And once, if you do put up with it until it clicks, it can be it's a great book then.
Yeah.
But I would say try the book. If you're not enjoying it, just go watch the movie. But if you are enjoying it, I would say the book and then the movie's probably a good way to do it.
You would probably enjoy for the book, I would say.
Do you think?
But yeah, like if you listen to the book first, I think you'd appreciate the film more. But obviously there's the other way of looking at it, that if you'd seen the film beforehand, you'll be able to put the characters to the names, and it will help your understanding, your sort of ability to follow the book. Because there's a lot of characters and there's a lot happening, as Michael says, it's very dense and can be a bit difficult to keep up with the lore. Yeah.
There's a lot of lore as well. It's kind of like, you know, Lord of the Rings books to movies, you know.
It's good.
Yeah.
Good read. Good listen.
Yeah.
I don't know how it slipped me by, the film, that is. Like, I don't know what was going on at the time. When was that released? 2 years ago or something?
I was still living in Belfast, I think. So maybe 2-3 years ago. 2021, maybe.
I had a newborn, that's what it was.
Ah, that'd be wild.
Makes sense now. And so I think I'll read the book first. I know that Pierce Brown, Red Rising author, he says it's one of his like inspirations. So, and that's my favourite book series, so big hope for this one.
Very different books.
I imagine they are, but hopefully Pierce has good taste. So that's kind of everything for me. We'll move on to plugs then. Michael and Johnny, you two always have plugs, so
I guess I'll go first. Yeah, just the YouTube channel. I've released a few videos there in the last few weeks. Just again about the Q language, which I use in my day job. Just kind of tutorial, like short videos, just showing different aspects of the language. Yeah, so you can check that out for that. And like, I hope they grow it on the other program and stuff in the future. But yeah, just find time here these days. You know, there's many audiobooks to be read and YouTube videos to be created and podcasts to be recorded. It's just all happening. And I don't even have a child yet, Chick. It's just, I don't know how you stay it.
Is there plans there? Or?
Well, in the next 20, 30 years, I'd say.
just the usual stuff for me. Check out The Dark Tales if you want some horror stories of varying lengths. I think the shortest story is about 10 minutes long. And then the biggest story, if you put them together, is... Actually, I don't know the length, but I know it's about 34,000 words. The White Winter ones came off, which is like just shy of a novella. Or if you prefer, I have a fantasy series as well. It's a fantasy book that I wrote like 4 years ago, Soulbonder. It was the first book that I wrote to try and teach myself how to write. It's a very flawed work, but it's still work that I am proud of for completing and seeing it through. And I think getting towards more the middle, still the early part of the book that's read out so far, but gradually clawing towards the middle, and I do think the climax is very satisfying, so just to build that up a bit. But check those out. And the links below. And Jonathan and I do a movie podcast as well, Real Report. We recorded an episode there not long ago, so I have to put that together along with this episode as well. Link for that will be in the show notes as well.
Cool. All right. Well, that sort of concludes my part of the episode. So we'll move on to Johnny for the next pick.
Yeah. So this book is probably going to be one that I'd say very few people have ever heard of or read. So I think he's can all probably have a guess. So it's this little indie book called The Hobbit, written by J.R. Tolkien and read by Andy Serkis. Who wants to have a guess first at what this book's about? Yeah, so obviously, I think the only absolute, you know, giant series, I know we've done a couple of epic fantasies, but absolute, like, I mean, appeals to everyone, not just the nerdy people. I'm pretty sure this, along with Harry Potter, you know, this is probably our second absolute humongous series that we're getting into here, so I'll obviously hope they cover the other Lord of the Rings books in future episodes. But yeah, I think starting off with The Hobbit, even though I know The Hobbit was written first, but in terms of the movies, people will be more familiar probably with The Lord of the Rings, but then maybe not, because The Hobbit's movies are more recent as well, so I guess maybe in a more recent generation they might have seen that. But I feel like The Hobbit's a nice, cozier book they read. Nice, a lighter book. There's definitely, obviously, dark parts in it and stuff. But yeah, I just feel like it's definitely a good, in terms of when you're going book-wise, it's definitely a good intro to the series.
Have you read it before, Johnny?
I have listened to, do you know what? I have the audiobook, so I have the audiobook on Audible, but it's narrated by somebody else. And this is before Andy Serkis did it. So I have just, it's also on Spotify's thing, included with a membership, so that one is the Andy Serkis one, so that's the one I'm going to, that's nice. So I've listened to the Two Towers with Andy Serkis, that was the first, so I actually listened to The Fellowship too, was narrated by somebody else. So yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing Andy Serkis doing the narrating.
I can't wait to talk with Tom Bombadil, but anyway.
Maybe if this, the next episode is an enjoyable one to record, we could do what we've done with the Harry Potter series and like open this as a series where we do like one of them annually, but it's up to you guys. We could see how the episode goes anyway, only, and see how it pans out.
Only if we do the similar index.
Oh yes, let's do that. Jack will love that. That's one of our requests.
If we're doing the similar, we're doing that after we've done the trilogy.
It's the one
yeah. You don't like poetry?
I haven't actually done any of the. Have you, like, done the Fall of Gondolin and all those kind of ones?
No, not actually, no.
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 I'd like to do those as well eventually, but yeah.
You say, I've listened to the full trilogy from narrated by Andy Serkis, and I love The Hobbit. Like, I've actually physically read The Hobbit twice. I actually would say it's probably my favorite book. If people have ever asked me, I would always have said The Hobbit is my favorite book, but I've never listened to the audiobook, so very excited to actually get round to it finally. So
nice.
Very good.
I was going to say, Jonathan, I think Jonathan's having his sneaky pick for, like, his crowd pleaser for Book of the Year again.
Michael, listen here. This is just absolute fucking, you know, calling people out for no reason. Lies and deceit. But yeah, if you don't all rate it 5 stars, I'll be furious.
I'm going to pick my... a little book you might have heard of called The Game of Thrones next.
Clang-a-dang-dong. Oh no, that's Clash of Kings, isn't it?
As much as you love The Game of Thrones, can you ever give a book that's like freaking 100 million hours 5 stars? Like,
yes.
Oh, I give first Game of Thrones easy 5 stars.
I don't know about the first one. 9 stars. I don't know about the first one.
Oh, easy.
Listen, we'll talk about the ratings for Game of Thrones when we get there. For right now, we're doing The Hobbit, and sure, we'll see.
It's definitely going to be dragged down. The score is going to go down for Tom Bombadil's chapters. It's going to, I'm going to pull it down for that.
He's not on The Hobbit, but isn't he? No,
I don't think he's on
The Hobbit.
He's in the Fellowship. He's in the Fellowship.
Oh, never mind it. Never mind it.
Nah.
Ignore all that.
You're back.
We're all
on
good.
Board.
That's a 5 there, Johnny. Good man. Happy days.
No, whoever picks The Fellowship.
Thank God,
was
actually,
because
fucking
hell. No baller then, just a... reiterate that again, that is The Hobbit by J.R. Tolkien, and that is narrated by Andy Serkis.
Well, Lewis, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Later.
Catch you on the
season.
We're all thinking it. Ha ha ha.